Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Randy Harper. Episode 176 for August 3rd, 2011. Colin Percival. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All stream directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to Netflix.com/twit. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open-source software. I'm your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneEngine.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, things you might not have heard about, things you might have heard way too much about, but we like to bring them on so we can chat with them about where they're headed and where they came from and all sorts of other things like that. But I'm usually joined by a co-host. Let's go ahead and bring our co-host for this week on. It's none other than Randy Harper, FreeBSD girl. Welcome back.
Thanks. How are you doing, Randall?
I'm doing pretty good, I'm very, very disoriented in the fact that I'm currently and constantly now on some travel schedule. I track my stuff with Kayak, and every single week now overlaps one trip, then the next, then the next, then the next. So when I go to Portland, I'm renting a car. When I come down here to Media Temple this week, where I'm working this week, I have to rent the hotel. So I'm always on some trip that Kayak, thankfully, is tracking for all me. So it's pretty good, but it's all imported into my iCal calendar. Of course, I've imported it as orange because that's Kayak's colors. Anyway, so I'm a little disoriented all the time. So yes, in fact, I'm back again in Media Temple's headquarters. They're providing the bandwidth for this and giving me a little bit of time off so I can do this. They also provide the microphone. That's the only reason I'm mentioning them, because they went and bought a microphone for me.
Nice.
This week we... Sorry, go ahead.
I said nice. I wish they would buy me a microphone.
Very pretty microphone, too, although it's just giant. I have to, like, move the laptop back to be able to put it on there. But that's not why we do this show. We don't do the show to talk about the mechanism behind how we do the show, although we do occasionally. We actually do the show because we have really great guests on the show. This week, particularly interesting, we've got Colin Percival on. Colin has been involved with the FreeBSD project for a very long time, has a couple of interesting positions with the FreeBSD project. We're bringing him on particularly to talk about something that I became aware of a few months ago, which is FreeBSD on EC2, the Amazon EC2 Compute Cloud. And Colin has managed to figure out how to get FreeBSD to work there alongside the traditional Linux and OpenSolaris and Windows AMIs that are normally provided there. He's figured out how to make FreeBSD work there, which is pretty interesting because I'm a FreeBSD lover and user. I have it for all my servers now. Thanks to you, Randy, actually.
Oh, well, I'm glad that somebody is using FreeBSD because of me.
There we go. I'm sure plenty of people are more aware of it because of you, so there we go. The other thing we're going to talk to him about is his other project, his for-profit project called TarSnap. And it's, as far as I can tell, it's sort of a competitor to something like Dropbox or where you're putting stuff in the clouds, except he's really paid a lot of attention to security on it. So we're hoping to get him to talk about some of the security aspects of that. Anything before we get started, Randy?
Nope. Let's go ahead and start.
Well, let's not quite go ahead and start, because before we do that, we want to talk about one of my favorite subjects, which is that Floss Weekly has sponsors. In particular, this sponsor this week is this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, or iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. So Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you, which saves you time, money, and hassle. And there are several easy ways to instantly access streaming movies and TV shows of Netflix. You can watch Netflix movies and TV shows on your Mac or PC or iPad. You can also watch on your iPhone and some Android phones too. I have the iPhone app. When I'm in a public transportation and I've got a few minutes to kill, I'll pull up Netflix and burn all my 3G time and watch whatever's going on there. If you have a gaming console like an Xbox 360, a PS3, a Nintendo Wii, you can also watch Netflix right on your TV. And I have a PS3 and it does beautiful 1080p on my PS3. It's really beautiful to work on that. If you're not a gamer, you can watch Netflix on your TV with an Apple TV or a Roku box. And I have a Roku and it does 720p just fine there. Eventually, I think it's going to be 1080p there as well. They're inexpensive, easy to use. With Netflix, you can watch movies and TV shows instantly using any of these devices. And when you begin watching a movie or a show on one device, you can finish on a different one. Whichever ways you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies and TV shows as you want, anytime you want, and you can cancel anytime. Try Netflix today for 30 days free if you go to netflix.com/twit. That will let you know that we sent them to you. And no, we sent them. No, we that we sent you to them. That probably makes more sense. Be sure to use that URL when you sign up for your free trial. That's netflix.com/TWIT. And we thank Netflix for their support of TWIT and Floss Weekly, and we hope that you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. And without further ado, let's go ahead and bring on our guest. Colin, welcome to the show.
Hello. Great to be here.
And where I got chastised for this last week. It's not where are we speaking to you from, it's where are you speaking to us from. So what would that be?
I'm speaking to you from Burnaby, which is a suburb of Vancouver, British Columbia.
So you're almost directly north of me, although quite a ways because I'm in LA. So, but enough about location and geography. Let's talk about why you're actually here. Which of the two projects do you want to talk about first? Do you want to talk about the FreeBSD on EC2, or do you want to talk about?
That's better, given that that is the more open source of the project.
Sure. So, what's the history of this? What problem is it solving, and how did you get started with it?
Well, Amazon's EC2 Compute Cloud has been around since around 2006. Mm-hmm. It started out as just a Linux system, but not everybody wants to run Linux. Mm-hmm. Myself, I'm a FreeBSD developer, a FreeBSD user, so I wanted to have the ability to run FreeBSD, particularly for my TerraSnap project, but also for other purposes. And just generally, I didn't like the idea that there was a service out there that Linux people could use, but FreeBSD people couldn't use. So I talked to some people at Amazon and said, you know, it would be really great if we could support FreeBSD on here. And eventually, I managed to get it working.
Okay, that's really great. Now, just to fill in a little bit for people who aren't familiar with EC2, this is essentially a cloud computing environment. In fact, it almost defines the cloud at this point, given how large and pervasive it is. But basically, I can come in as an individual user or as a corporation and say, I would like 5 machines running, but I have to tell it what I want running. And they do this through the use of, do you pronounce it AMI or just AMI, these machines?
I think it's just AMI. So, okay, yes. The way EC2 works is it's rent by the hour virtual machines. Mm-hmm. So you can go in there, say, I want 5 machines, 10 machines, 100 machines for the next hour. Or rather, you say, I want to start 100 machines right now. And then mm-hmm. you can stop them at some later point, and then you only get charged for the number of hours that you're actually using them. And when you launch them, you specify which machine image to launch. So there's standard machine images for different Linux distributions, and it's actually very easy on EC2 for people to take one machine image, make some changes to it, like say installing a web server, and then bundle that into a new machine image, so that then the next time they want to launch another web server, they just launch their pre-built image that has the web server already installed.
So in the interface to begin with, I remember seeing a pull-down list of like, you know, basic Linux installations and some Windows installations, and eventually I also saw some Open Solaris installations there. That was much later, though. I think maybe a year or two down the line. But these are just core installations. Then if I could either just keep starting one of these and then maybe running Puppet on it or something to bring it up to speed, but you're saying that I can then also use some sort of tools to make my own AMI that is configured in my particular way and start from that instead.
Right, and there's actually two ways of doing it. You can either take disk images and tell EC2 create me an AMI out of these disk images, or you can say take this instance which is currently running and bundle that into a new image. So then what it does is it stops the instance, it creates snapshots of the volumes, and then uses the pre-existing code for creating an AMI out of snapshotted volumes.
Yay. I'm trying to think, though. So we've had VirtualBox on the show. So we know people that have been longtime listeners of the show are familiar with the concept of a virtual machine that's running some sort of machine image. What's the trickiness then? I mean, I know that I can put anything I want in VirtualBox. I can mount whatever DVD I want that's an installation DVD and build my own image from there. Is there anything particularly tricky about EC2 that made FreeBSD hard to do for that?
The real problem with EC2 is it's based on Xen. I love Xen, but back in the early days of Xen, they were doing everything with power virtualization. This was before newer CPUs came out with hardware support for virtualization. EC2 being one of the first big users of Xen, were using power virtualization, and well, big companies move slowly. They have, I don't know, 100,000 servers or something. They're not going to switch over to using hardware virtualization quickly. Most people are using hardware virtualization. So when it came to getting FreeBSD running, not many people were interested in FreeBSD power virtualized Xen support. So we have some code for 32-bit machines, but it doesn't really work all that well.
Now, we've had the Xen guys actually on, too, and I remember them saying something like, this is right about time the Amazon was announcing EC2. So just to remind us, and what's per, I can get technical. This is a technical show. What's the difference between power virtualization and the other kind that, say, VirtualBox has that lets me put anything I want on it?
Okay, so the idea here is certain instructions can't be safely emulated on the standard x86 architecture. There's some instructions which, if you're running with it as the kernel with Bing Zero, it's called privileges, they will operate one way. If you're not running with Bing Zero, they will just silently do something else. The standard way of doing virtualization is you have these instructions trap, and then you can emulate them. But because x86 doesn't trap them, it's not possible to do emulation that way. So the idea with power virtualization is, instead of trying to load paging tables, for instance, and having that trap and be emulated, you make a call into the hypervisor and you say, hey, hypervisor, please map this page for me.
So instead of the idea of a virtual machine actually being able to say, pretend I'm on real hardware, a paravirtualized kernel has to know that certain operations aren't available to it and actually call out to some sort of cooperative piece of software that actually does the real thing that they would have done directly in hardware.
Exactly. And under the new way of doing things, the hardware virtualization method, you can run an unmodified kernel, and then we'll just emulate things for you. With power virtualization, you need the changes to your kernel code, which is one of the reasons why they started doing this on Linux, and then they did some work in Cambridge to produce a power virtualized version of Windows, but couldn't release that because, of course, Microsoft didn't want them releasing modified versions of Windows.
And so the trouble with getting FreeBSD up was that there wasn't already a paravirtualized compatible with Xen version of FreeBSD?
More or less. There have been a number of different versions of Xen with incompatible interfaces. FreeBSD had code which worked with one version of Xen, but not with a particular version of Xen which EC2 is using. There are also problems relating to using PAE, which is a way of accessing more than 4 gigabytes of memory on a 32-bit architecture. And then also all sorts of other problems with just the code not being tested, because most people, by the time that we were into 2006, 2007, were starting to move on to hardware virtualization.
So did Amazon get involved in helping you out with all this? I know their system is kind of different from the usual Xen that we all know and love.
I wouldn't say it's so much different as much as it is just old. I spent a long time talking to people at Amazon, and they were very happy to help me out, give me some information about how things worked within EC2. I did sign an NDA, so some of these things I can't talk about. But certainly they were willing to support me in terms of helping explain things. But what they couldn't do was contribute time towards fixing FreeBSD, because that's really not their job.
So how long have you been working on this?
Well, it depends how you define working. I mean, I've been in communication with people at Amazon since 2006. I think it was 2 days after they announced EC2 that I started emailing people at Amazon saying, hey, I don't know what the problems are. Let me know so I can see if I can get FreeBSD working. But for long periods in there, FreeBSD's Xen code wasn't working, I didn't have the expertise necessary to fix the power virtual bits. So there really wasn't much I could do.
So let's talk a little bit about your history with FreeBSD. I mean, why were you interested in getting FreeBSD there? What place do you see FreeBSD being in the EC2 market?
Well, for EC2 specifically, the reason I got interested in it in the first point was I started working towards running this online data backup service, my TarSnap service, and Amazon's S3 storage service was sort of the ideal place for me to store people's backups. With EC2, this would provide me with a way to have code running, which was sort of close to S3 in a sense of having low latency for communications and also not have to pay for bandwidth between the logic and the storage system. As far as interest in FreeBSD before that, and more generally, I've been using FreeBSD since, I think, 1999 or so. When my parents first got a cable modem, everybody in the house wanted to use it, so we needed to set up some sort of NAT system to share the access between everybody in the house. My brother originally set up a box running OpenBSD to do this. At some point it broke. I can't remember exactly how it broke or why it broke, but I needed to set up a new system to do it. And I tried to install OpenBSD, found it was too difficult, installed FreeBSD instead because I found sysinstall was very straightforward, and I've been using FreeBSD ever since.
Sysinstall being straightforward, that's the first time I've heard that ever.
I think it is a very unusual reaction to sysinstall, but all I can say is back 13 or so years ago, sysinstall was certainly easier for me to figure out than what OpenBSD was using.
I remember the OpenBSD installer. You actually had to read the documentation in order to use it, which did detract from the experience a little bit.
That may well be why I did not find it easy to use.
So when did you start getting involved in the FreeBSD project?
So around 2003, I was in Oxford working on my doctorate, doing some programming. I was originally working on distributed systems and trying to build a distributed system for doing large-scale computations. And I wanted to have a server to control everything. FreeBSD was the obvious choice for that. But because I was going to be asking people to run my code on their systems, I wanted to have pretty good security on it, in particular security for the server. So I got interested in FreeBSD security at that point, and one of the things that I found was updating the box every time there was a security advisory was very difficult. You had to update the source code, you had to build world or build kernel depending upon what the patch was, you had to install things and reboot. Every time I went through this process, I had to read the updating file to remind myself what order to do steps in. Otherwise, I did the kernel and the world the wrong way around, and the system wouldn't boot. And on a slow server at that point, it took several hours to do a build world. So I figured it shouldn't be all that hard to produce a binary system for doing updates. So I started working on this, and I think it was August of 2003, I went to the BSDCon conference and presented FreeBSD Update, which was my binary update system for FreeBSD.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to do it's fascinating stuff there. But you mentioned TarSnap just a bit earlier, and I know we're going to talk about this in a little more depth right now. What is TarSnap, and how does it why was it part of the motivation for getting all this stuff to work on EC2?
So TarSnap is my online backup service. Mm-hmm. This came about because I've done a lot of work in computer security as FreeBSD security officer and also just more generally with other projects, pointing out problems when I noticed them. And I wanted good backups. in terms of the life of the system administrator, managing to keep the system updated was something I dealt with via FreeBSD Update and port snap. Doing backups is another pretty key thing to have.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted good backups. I wanted secure backups in particular. And I looked around and I really couldn't find anything out there. So I figured, I know how to do this stuff. I want this. I asked around and lots of other people said that they also wanted it. So I figured, well, build it and they will come. So I went ahead and started building TurfSnap.
And just so we get an identification of where this sort of fits in the ecosystem, this is, say, maybe a competitor to Dropbox or Voila or one of these other services that provide some sort of secure storage in the cloud then.
It's similar in the sense of doing online backup. I wouldn't say that those services provide secure backup in the cloud exactly. I have maybe a bit more stringent definition of the word secure. Certainly they make some effort towards security, but not necessarily enough.
Well, without invoking lawsuits here, is there a chance that you can tell us what your complaints are?
Dropbox... There's been lots of discussions over the past few months about it. They can look at all of your data, for instance. They need to do this for their deduplication. It saves them a lot of money to be able to recognize when two different people have the same data. And in order to do that, they need to have people upload the data unencrypted. They say, oh, we encrypt everything before it goes on to S3, but that really doesn't matter because they still have the encryption keys. They can still read off your data. One of the key points behind TurfSnap is everything is encrypted on the client side. When you register a machine, it generates some cryptographic keys, sends some keys to the server saying these are the keys I will use to authenticate myself. But all of the actual encryption keys are kept client side, and without those keys, you will not be able to read someone's data. I have no idea what data people are uploading, except I know the volume and I have some idea of how much it compresses based on the way the deduplication works on uncompressed data, and then compressed data gets uploaded.
Okay, so just so you understand the interface to this then, I've been studying a little bit in preparation for today's show. I essentially register myself with your service, and since this is a for-hire service, I also deposit some money with you to let me be a user. And then I invoke commands that look very similar, look like to just normal tar commands, except the tar commands were putting the archive somewhere in the cloud.
Right. So with tar, you would say tar-c-f, and then the name of the tar ball you want to create. With TurfSnap, you say tar-snap-c-f, and then the name of the archive you want to create with TurfSnap. TurfSnap is actually built around the BSD tar and libarchive systems. I ripped out some code and added in a whole bunch of new code, but all of the basic tar functionality, all of the standard command line you get with tar, it's all in there from the original BSD tar code.
Okay, and so let's say I want to use this to make, say, frequent backups of my machine. I want to, have some cron job that does it today and does it tomorrow. Aren't I going to have to send up everything tomorrow again if I use the tar-c, or is there some way to say only send the stuff that's different?
Right, so the way TurfSnap works, you have a snapshot and model, so every time you create a new archive, it acts as a snapshot of what you currently have on your disk, and these snapshots are broken up into chunks, of course. But then each snapshot acts as being completely independent of all the other snapshots, so it's different from a standard full backup plus incrementals model. So as a result, you can do rather like Time Machine works, create a whole bunch of archives, and then sort of sparsify them later on. And in fact, if you look online, you'll find there's, half a dozen or so scripts that people have written for going through their TurfSnap archives and then deleting some of them based on parameters, one archive per day for so many days, and then one archive per week for so many weeks, stuff like that.
Now, just from a sort of a high-level point of view, then, how do I know that the data that I'm shipping to your TurfSnap servers is secure? How do I know that that you're not somehow have some backdoor, maybe in the client set up something or whatever. I mean, you know, where do I get my trust from?
Well, the source code is there. You can look at it. Please mm-hmm. do look at it. If you find bugs, please let me know. TarSnap actually has a bug bounty, not just for security bugs, but in fact for any bugs, going right down to typos in source code comments. And in fact, sometime soon I'm going to be writing a blog post entitled What Does $1,000 of Bugs Look Like? Because over the past 3 months, people have been sending me a long list of bugs, most of them in the category of typos and comments, spelling mistakes. But then a whole bunch of harmless bugs as well. You know, in this particular error path, this memory isn't freed properly. And then a few actual bugs, including things like if you have a file which was created 280 billion years ago, the file timestamp will not be recorded correctly in the archive. This was a bug with converting 2 to the power 64, minus 2 to the power 63 into decimal.
So what's the most serious bug that's been found by people so far?
The most serious bug, and actually the only security bug, was a bug found back in January, something like January 23rd, I think, which is a bug in the handling of nonces for file encryption. When TarSnap uploads chunks to the server, it encrypts each of them using the same 256-bit AES key for each backup session, but with a different nonce for each file. At least that was the theory for it. When I wrote the original code for this, I looked over it very carefully and made sure it worked, and that was good. Unfortunately, about 2 years ago, I was adding support for passphrased key files, and in the process of doing this, I decided to refactor some of my code. It turned out that in the process of refactoring, I deleted a ++. So instead of having all of these files be encrypted using different nonces, they were all encrypted using the same nonce. So that was a really serious cryptographic bug in TarSnap. I did my best to fix it. I notified all the TarSnap customers about it, and provided a utility people could use for re-encrypting their data using new keys. These things happen. I do my best to look for bugs, and in fact, I've now added to my pre-release checklist, audit all changes to cryptographic code, including things that look like they're just cosmetic. And this was actually one of the reasons I set up the bug bounties as well. For about a week before I release a new version of TarSnap, it's going to be publicly available for people to look at. And in fact, during that period, there's going to be double the normal bug bounty for any new bugs that I introduced, just to encourage people to find any problems before they actually cause problems for people using TarSnap.
So you've been pretty open about bugs that have been found with TarSnap so far, but you're also really open with bugs you find with other backup services. What's that about?
Well, what it comes down to is I believe that security is something users need to understand. Users need to know what to look for. Users need to know, you know, if they see something on a website, does it actually make any sense? You know, people advertise, oh, we've got 448-bit encryption. Well, in actual fact, 448-bit encryption generally means they're using Blowfish, which is a really, really old block cipher and really a bad thing to use at the moment. So even though someone would normally think, oh, 448 is larger than 256, it's actually a bad sign, not a good sign. Beyond that, I've done a lot of work in security, open source security, and I hope that developers can learn security better. Here in Canada, there's a TV show called actually, I can't remember what it's called. No, it's Homes on Homes. That's what it is, which features this guy called Mike Holmes, who's a contractor. And he gets called in when people have problems in their homes that they can't fix. And the way these shows always work is the first half of the show, he goes through and sort of takes apart the house and points at all the things that are wrong. You know, this pipe should have been put over there. This isn't properly waterproof. I don't know all the details. And then the second half, he fixes things and fixes things properly. And I like to take the same approach to blog posts I write about security. I think it's important for people to see both what is done wrong and also how can we do it right. Because if you only see one of those, you're not really going to completely understand things.
So we talked about how you're competing with programs like Dropbox and things like that. One of my problems with Dropbox is that, for one, last time I checked, it's not in the FreeBSD ports tree. They don't support FreeBSD out of the box. What operating systems does Tarsnap support out of the box?
It runs on basically everything POSIXy. So FreeBSD, NetBSD, OpenBSD, a whole bunch of Linuxes, OpenSolaris. I think someone was running it on Eryx. It doesn't run on Herd, but I don't know if anybody actually wants to run it on Herd. There's a fix I need to make for that. Cygwin as well. It works fine there. There's a few other more obscure Unixes that people have tried it on that it works fine on. I can't remember all of them. It doesn't run on Windows, which I think is probably what you're trying to get at here.
Is there any plans to eventually let it run on Windows?
At some point, yes. Tarsnap is built around BSD tar and libarchive. The version of those which Tarsnap is currently using doesn't have very good Windows support, but newer versions of those have good Windows support. So when I get around to it, I will be updating to a newer libarchive, at which point it should be fairly straightforward to run on Windows, but no guarantees. I know Windows sometimes does odd things. And at the moment, I don't have a Windows development box anyway. So I'll need to try it and see how it works.
So what's your business model? I mean, how are you making money off Tarsnap?
Well, it works with essentially a utility model. So as Randall was saying earlier, you create an account and you deposit money into it. And then you start doing backups. And over the course of months or years in some cases, the money gets slowly drawn out of your account just based on the amount of usage you have. So it's a flat price per gigabyte of storage and per gigabyte of bandwidth each month.
Well, you've open sourced all the stuff to make this work, though. So what would keep me from just, or maybe you haven't, maybe you held something back. I mean, couldn't I just go into competition with you?
The Tarsnap server code is not public. That's mostly just because it's not useful to anybody at the moment. But also, there are things in there that I guess you could call them technical advantages over the competition. As far as the client code works, it is public, but it's not actually under an open source license. I release bits and pieces here more or less whenever someone says, oh, this file would be useful to me. Can you put it under an open source license? I say, sure, here's a BSD license on it. But the entire client code, because I have this crazy idea that it would be nice to eat, I do want to keep that proprietary in the sense of you can't take it and set up your own backup service using it.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, it sounds like the kind of thing that, you know, I get this a lot from people that are like, you know, Free Software Foundation, or excuse me, I shouldn't mention them by name, but free software people who say, oh, all software must be open and free sourced and stuff. And, you know, really, it's up to the individual authors to make choices about things like this. And you've made a choice that's working for you. And that's completely appropriate. I want to ask one more question before we go back to EC2, because I have a few more questions about EC2 still. Why not Canada for people who can use Tarsnap?
So originally that was a matter of the sales tax laws being very complicated, particularly as far as British Columbia goes. In Canada, we have a federal sales tax, and most provinces also have provincial sales taxes. The federal sales tax is fairly straightforward for most things, but there are some things it doesn't specify, like how do you charge tax on Pico dollars. They assume that every time you're going to be charging tax on something, you're going to be sending someone an invoice for a certain number of dollars and a certain number of cents, and then they have a formula that tells you how much tax to charge. That works fine for most things, but with a service model like Tarsnap, where you're using it continuously, and your each byte costs you money, it doesn't really say what to do for charging taxes on that. The British Columbia provincial sales tax is actually a lot worse. It has all sorts of categories for what is taxable and what isn't taxable. There's data storage services, and then there's data processing services, and then there's communications services, which in some cases have different taxes based on how far data is traveling within the province versus outside of the province. Fortunately, British Columbia has actually moved to a harmonized sales tax, which works with the same rules as the federal sales tax. There's actually a referendum going on at the moment to see whether we keep that or switch back to the provincial sales tax. So if there's anybody here watching from British Columbia, please vote no on the referendum ballot. You have until Friday to send it in.
Well, that's fair to have a little bit of political activism here. And I actually wanted to just address that just for one more second there. So what I read in the FAQ, and actually what I blogged about too once I saw this, was that it seems to me that the complexities of the tax code really do seem to throw a monkey wrench into those of us who really want to provide virtual services, distribute virtual goods. And is that anything that you're also politically interested in, or is it just you're just saying I just want to deal with a Tarsnap?
Well, in Canada, it's not all that bad because we have the federal tax and then provincial taxes, and actually now most provinces are harmonized with the federal taxes. In the U.S., I understand it's more complicated that you have state taxes and then county taxes and city taxes. I remember talking to someone a few years ago, and he was saying that there was something like 200,000 different tax rules that they would need to worry about. So in the U.S., I think you certainly do need to simplify things. In Canada, I think it's fine, except for the BC provincial sales tax, which I hope will not be coming back.
Well, the one saving throw that we have in the U.S. is that we still have this notion of physical presence. So unless you have a physical entity in a state or a city or a county, you don't have to collect the tax. So that's a broad sweep. There's a few exceptions to that. But that would save the situation that you're facing, which is that you don't have a physical presence except in B.C. So you would not have to deal with anything related to collecting taxes in the eastern part of Canada if you had the same rules the U.S. had.
Yeah, Canada works with that same process. So, if BC goes back to the provincial sales tax, I might end up saying, well, Canadians are fine except not in BC, because I wouldn't need to worry about complicated sales taxes for other provinces. I would only need to worry about the federal sales tax. Of course, these days, Amazon seems to be having issues with different states trying to broaden their definitions of physical presence. So I don't know how long that simple approach to just saying I'm not going to deal with that complicated sales tax over there is going to work in the U.S.
So, and one more thing on Tarsnap before we go back to EC2. I keep saying this, but this is going to be the last question, really. Pico dollars, what the hell?
Well, we have SI units. You have a dollar, you have a milli dollar, you have a micro dollar, you have a nano dollar, you have a pico dollar.
Okay. And why pico dollars? Why not just specify it in terms of dollars per megabyte or something?
I was originally going to say 30 cents per gigabyte for bandwidth and that much per month for storage. But then people keep on arguing about what a gigabyte is. I'm a mathematician, I'm a scientist. As far as I'm concerned, we have SI units. A gigabyte is 1 billion bytes. Mm-hmm. Some people say, oh, it's actually 1.073 billion bytes. So I figured it's a lot easier just to avoid that argument and say I'm charging 300 picodollars per byte. Nobody's going to think that a picodollar is 2 to the minus 40 dollars. Everybody knows it's 2 to the minus 12, 10 to the minus 12 dollars.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's a great way to get around that. I appreciate that, and appreciate almost the humor in it as well. Although I remember measurements in the VAX VMS system of things like furlongs per fortnight, just to get around the fact that it wasn't really equal to anything useful. So, but that's a long story about a time of mine a long time ago. So back on EC2 for a bit now.
Of course. Being from Canada, I'm used to the metric system. You Luddites down in the US may have trouble with these SI prefixes, but in most of the world, people have no trouble with them.
Yeah, well, we Americans hardly even realize, you know, how far most things are. There was some sort of, I remember a quiz show being talked about recently where they couldn't figure out how far a yard was compared to a foot. I went, oh my God, that's just horrible.
Are you
smarter than a fifth? Yeah, are you smarter than a fifth grader? That somebody actually, you know, somebody's a yard and a half tall. How tall is that in feet? And they were saying something like 100 feet. It was like, what? Where's the math going here? Okay, I'm getting distracted now. So back on EC2 for a bit. I did, when we first talked about doing the show, I actually took and built an EC2 instance. And I mounted an EBS drive that I formatted as ZFS, which I prefer actually for my file system. I noticed your AMIs right now, they use just UFS for booting. Is there a chance that maybe you can get a ZFS boot version soon, or is that going to be impossible based on what's going on?
If people want ZFS root FreeBSD instances, I could do it. Not on the micro instances. ZFS gets very unhappy if you try to run it on a system with only 600 megabytes of RAM. I actually keep a log of panics. There's an option which you can turn off if you want, but I have it on by default for the AMIs I release, that it will send me an email if the system panics. And most of the panics I get at the moment are people trying to run ZFS on micro instances because it just does not work.
Okay, cool.
But
on
systems with lots of memory, sure, you can run ZFS there, and if there's enough interest, I can figure out how to do ZFS root. I've never used ZFS personally. I find UFS is good enough for what I want to do. But this is one of the reasons that people have been asking for FreeBSD on EC2 for a long time. With Solaris sort of going away, a lot of the people who were running Solaris in EC2 said, we really want to have a way to keep running ZFS. And FreeBSD is now sort of the standard platform for running ZFS.
Now, an AMI has to be built specifically for a size of instance. What do you have available now, and are you supporting all those in the future as well?
It doesn't have to be specific to one instance, but there's certain categories that it doesn't really make much sense to mix some between. So FreeBSD, I released a 32-bit instance for micro instances, sorry, a 32-bit image for micro instances back in December, and I've been updating it. And actually, just before I came on this show, I was building another 8.2 release image with some extra patches. It's probably finished building by now. So if people want to follow me on Twitter, probably half an hour or so after we finish here, I will be announcing the new AMI for that.
Great.
Beyond that, there's 64-bit FreeBSD for cluster compute instances. These were created by Amazon, I assume, in response to companies that wanted to do large cluster computations, because these instances have, I think, 8 cores, 23 gigabytes of RAM, 10 gigabit Ethernet connecting them. So these are the really hefty instances, and 64-bit FreeBSD runs on there just fine. That's actually via HVM, hardware virtualization. This was the first platform they released for HVM. Mm-hmm. And then I've also released 64-bit FreeBSD images for which run on any of the standard 64-bit Windows instances.
Cool. Although I think you have to pay for the Windows license for that then? an extra
right.
charge.
So one of the interesting things about EC2, although it uses only power virtualization on the Unix side, apart from the cluster compute instances, Windows doesn't run with power virtualization. So in order for them to support Windows on EC2, which a lot of people did want to use Windows for some reason, I don't know why, they had to provide hardware virtualization for Windows. So I managed to trick EC2 into running FreeBSD on those by launching a Windows instance, stopping it, removing its disk, putting in a FreeBSD disk, then booting it up again. And then I was running FreeBSD, pretending to be Windows, though. And then all I did was tell EC2, please create me a new image out of this running instance. So in order to have FreeBSD images, which are still labeled as Windows instances, which you can launch whenever you want. And yes, you do have to pay the extra cost for the Windows license. At least I assume it's a Windows license, which is the reason why it costs more. But it does allow you a lot of other options in terms of instance sizes, because the micro is about a tenth of a CPU, and the cluster compute is 8 cores. So most people want to have something somewhere in between those two.
And just to continue the notion of freeze and beer for this particular podcast, I believe right now, are they still running the special where you can have a micro instance for up to a year for new customers?
Yes. New accounts created with Amazon Web Services, they have a whole bunch of different things that you get for free. And one of them is, I think it's 750 hours of micro instance. So essentially, one instance running continuously per month. And then there's a bit of S3 storage, I think, some I/O for the disk. Essentially, they clearly wanted to set it up so that you can run whatever you want in there just to try it out without actually paying for it.
And so your FreeBSD instance for that micro would work just fine in that?
For the micro instance works fine there, yes. And actually, the free tier for new users, they give you 10 gigabytes of Elastic block storage disks free, and I set the size of the AMI to 10 gigabytes so that you would use all the space that you can use without paying for it.
Wow. So if anybody just wants a free BSD box in the cloud with their brand new users to AWS, they can certainly take advantage of this, at least for now, huh?
Yeah, as far as I know, there's no plans to stop doing this. They wouldn't tell me, but I've certainly seen no indication that they would plan on stopping this.
Now, you've probably compared the speed and performance and things like that of EC2 instances to other cloud providers, I presume. So is it comparable, or should I look at other places first, or what?
I haven't actually done any tests personally. Mm-hmm. A lot of people out there have, though. I mean, as far as the CPUs go, you get a certain CPU, and you do whatever you want with it. The networking and the disk... there's a whole bunch of benchmarks out there, and they seem to be utterly inconsistent. This may be that the EBS Elastic Block Store has inconsistent performance, which is a complaint I have heard about it, or it may just be that people don't know how to do benchmarks, which is a problem I have seen many times. So I can't really tell you which is better of EC2 or other systems.
Well, it certainly sounds like a lot of interesting work that you've had to do to make this work. Are you working with anybody else on this, or are you just flying solo and not looking for help?
As far as EC2 goes, I've basically been working on my own, although I have to say some companies have been very generous in sponsoring me to do certain work on it. Only once I got the first instance out there was this great chicken and egg problem of companies saying, "Well, we'd love to support this, but we can't give money towards experimental work. So let us know once it's working, and then we can pay you to get it working."
So, other than your TarSnap operation, are there other people we might know of that you could mention that are using this product already?
There are a number of companies using FreeBSD on EC2. I haven't got any particular list. People okay. can just go ahead and use it. They don't have to tell me. I can tell you that the latest work I've been doing was sponsored by Line Rate Systems. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that name means anything to you. To be honest, it didn't mean anything to me until they emailed me and said, "We'd like to pay you to work on this."
Well, that's the best kind of email you can get, right?
It is very nice to be paid to work on open source code, yes.
I probably should have asked you, what's your day job? How do you support yourself? Is it not Tarsnap, obviously?
Well, it's Tarsnap plus consulting, mm-hmm. which is FreeBSD and other work as it comes along.
Okay, so if people want to contact you about all that sort of stuff, they certainly can too. You're not going to stop them.
I'm always happy to have people come and offer me money.
Okay, well, I'm just about down to the end of my list and down to the end of the hour. So is there anything that we left out that you really want to make sure our audience is aware of?
I can't think of anything in particular. FreeBSD 9.0 is coming out soon. Beta 1 was just released. I don't have AMIs for this yet, but you can download the CD and start playing with it. We can always use more people testing betas.
Very cool, very cool. And I've got to ask, because I got yelled at for not asking the last two shows, Emacs or VI?
Neither. I do most of my work in Kwrite, and if I'm in a terminal shell, I usually use Nano.
Okay, that's a fair answer, though. I mean, Nano's sort of Emacs-y-like, so I guess it's probably closer to that.
I never saw the point getting involved in these arguments. when I started doing C development, I was using Wacom C, and Kwrite is sort of the closest thing I found to the editor that they had with Wacom C. So I just use what's close to what I'm used to, and I don't see any reason to try anything else. It works.
Yep, and now so I can just dig another grave for myself, your favorite scripting language?
POSIX shell.
Wow.
Be that way.
I will note that FreeBSD Update and PortSnap are both written in POSIX shell. They're both around 2,000 lines of code.
Oh, okay. Okay. No, that's fine. I'm just always shocked when I hear people say shell is their favorite shell. But okay, that's great.
I would expect a bigger beard for someone who's saying POSIX shell.
Yeah, where's your beard?
I shaved a few days ago, I'm afraid.
Now you just got a trendy hipster beard, that's all. It'll work fine. Well, Colin, I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show today and talk about your two main projects, and especially enlighten me a little bit more about what the CC2 release is all about. And I may actually be one of your Tarsnap customers coming up soon, because that's something I've also been looking for as well. So I want to thank you for taking the time to come on the show.
Thank you.
That was Colin Percival, who is lots and lots of things relative to the FreeBSD community, the security officer since 2005. He's also been a core team member since 2010 and a committer since 2004, worked on Tarsnap since 2006, lots of stuff in the last decade there, launched publicly in 2008. So also an Amazon EC2 guy and making FreeBSD work on there. What do you think, Randy? How did that go for you?
I think it was a great show. There's a lot of low-level discussion there, but came across really well.
Good deal, good deal. And you were already familiar with a lot of this stuff. Actually, you and Colin are like friends or been around together for a long time?
We have been friends for, 8 or 9 years now. He is still my mentor for FreeBSD. So anytime I'm going to quit code, which admittedly hasn't been in a while, it has to go through him first. He has to approve it. So when things break in sysinstall, old sysinstall, you can blame him. It's all his fault. We should have caught the problems.
Well, now I know who to put. Now I know who to point fingers at for that particular code. Anyway, I really like the fact that when I first looked at Amazon EC2 and it came out, and I was looking at it like, I really don't want to go back to running Linux, and I really mean it that way, in the sense that I ran Linux maybe 8 or 9 years ago for Sun.com, and I switched to OpenBSD probably 6-7 years ago, something like that. Then when Amazon came along and it was just Linux and Windows, I said, what's the point of all that? But then they announced OpenSolaris. So I actually started a project where we were moving people off of my OpenBSD box. So insightcruises.com, actually. We moved them off and got an Amazon OpenSolaris instance. And I bet OpenSolaris is okay if you've sort of grown up with Solaris, but it was too different for me. I really just couldn't get to it. And the ZFS on root was really a huge advantage. So I really kept looking at that going, that's what I got to keep working with. And then when we did the show with you, actually it was, and I realized that ZFS was, you can boot root with ZFS on FreeBSD, and that the ports catalog was huge. And I had the PF firewall. I went, well, here's what I want to use instead. So we now have moved everybody off of Amazon. We're now on ARP Networks, my hosting company, and Insight Cruise's hosting company, and we're using FreeBSD virtual instances there. But now it looks like, given Colin's work, that I could actually burst to Amazon if I wanted to, or at least have another choice in my hosting solution. So I'm really happy that he's been doing this work and that I've been discovering about that. TarSnap looks like a great project as well. If you need a secure backup solution by somebody who pays attention to security, not to say the other ones don't. See, I don't want to get a lawsuit here. So please, we just had Colin on. That's why it's Colin's show. So, but just the fact that he's got the security thing going on. So what's your experience of Colin's level of paying attention to security?
Well, he's been the security officer in FreeBSD for quite some time. And I know he's always been security minded.
Very good. Very good. Well, cool. Speaking of security-minded, that's my awkward transition today for coming up with the upcoming guests. I just have some awkward transition every time. I think it's part of the joke now for all that. We do have a lot of people still on the queue, ready to be talked to, chatted with, all that sort of stuff. Next week, we have Perry McDowell works with Delta 3D, which was built originally on government contracts as sort of a reality engine. So we've got the things in there to take care of like physics, things colliding, things like that, plus also all the visuals related to all that. So giant reality engine being used in a lot of government contracts, but also has applicability in building 3D games and stuff. So he's going to be a lot of fun to talk with next week. We have coming after that, we have Chris Schoenermann, something like that. I should get a pronunciation guide. I keep saying this. Anyway, if I mispronounce your name, not delivered. Talking about Synergy, which is a great thing that allows you, when you have multiple machines sitting on your desk, to use the same mouse and keyboard across all the machines just by moving your mouse in the right direction or the other direction. And Randy, you're coming back on that show because you're a user of this, right?
Absolutely. I've been using this for years. It's a great, great program.
Well, it'd be fun really to talk to Chris and see how it all came up with it and what these problems have been getting to work since. Brian Call, Leif Hedstrom are going to come to us, talk to us about Apache Traffic Server. I actually saw them last week at OSCON, and they were saying, well, I'm looking forward to our show, so it'll be really fun. Apache Traffic Server is originally the Yahoo project to serve as a high-performance thing, kind of like Nginx or somewhere in that category, maybe using Mod Proxy and Apache. But the Apache Traffic Server is really about high-volume websites. Observium, after that, Adam Armstrong is going to talk to us about this Sentry Network Management Services, being able to see what's up and down in your network. A lot more people on the short list. And so you can go to twit.tv/floss, and there's a spreadsheet link from there to tell you who's actually coming up. If you have a project that doesn't end up on that list or you can't see on that list, you can email me, merlin@stonehenge.com, but don't email me. Have the project leader email me. So write to the project and say, I really want you on Floss Weekly. Here's why. It's one of my favorite shows, blah, blah, blah. And then have them email me. And that's how almost everybody that we're getting today in the last year or so has come from project leaders emailing me instead of the other way around. Because if you just tell me about a project, I don't have time to go research. I'm sorry. I have to crowdsource the show to make it all work. Speaking of OSCON, by the way, before I get to that, though, you can also, when we announce new guests, we do it now with our new Twitter handle and Identica handle of Floss Weekly. So you can follow Floss Weekly directly, all one word. And you can get announcements about when I book new guests, what guest is coming up this week. And sometimes I even also tweet that the show is coming up in an hour or so when I remember to do that. So if you follow that, you can also follow me, Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N, if you also want to find out where my Foursquare check-ins are. And I also do occasionally tweet open source knowledge and stuff there. And again, speaking of OSCON, just got back from OSCON, the big open source convention. There's record attendance, 3,500 people were at OSCON this year. Huge show. And in my home city of Portland, Oregon, made it easy for me to get to. I went around and gathered about a half a dozen new potential guests. So I saw some really exciting stuff going on there. More on that as we get the Q4 scheduled. If you're also wanting to follow me and want to annoy me by showing up where I'm at, stalking me, I guess would be the word, but no, it's fine. Please do. I'm going to be at Chris Marquardt's photo workshop in San Francisco from August 18th to 21st. There's a show on night photography, a whole workshop on night photography. I've done three or four of Chris's workshops before, and it's just been really great. So I'm glad to be there again. And if you tweet me or email me, I just gave my email address a moment ago, and you want to hook up sometime when I have some spare time while I'm there, please do. Particularly on the evening of August 18th, there's an open meeting to meet up with Chris. So watch for Chris's tweets on that. I'm going to be at DragonCon September 1st through 5th. I'm attending for the ninth year in a row, I think it is, speaking for the ninth year in a row. And I'm actually doing the Lessons Learned from Flossing Weekly that we did a few weeks ago here in the stream. I'm actually going to be doing that there at DragonCon. So again, if you're in the Atlanta area and want to meet up with me, again, email me, tweet me, whatever you want to do, and I will catch up with you. I may be at the cottage itself on September 15th, which is a Thursday. There's a lot of reasons that I can't tell you whether that's for sure or not. But so I may also be in the Petaluma area coming up soon. Again, follow me on Twitter, Identica. I'm also on Google Plus. If you're one of the Google Plus things, I'm Randall L. Schwartz there. So try to find me that way. That's enough plugs for me. I'd like to thank Randy in her absence for her helping out with the show again this week. And she'll be back again in 2 weeks. And I'm sure she'll be able to tell us more about her life and her story and everything like that at then. So without further ado, since I hear the music coming up, we'll just have to see you again next time on Floss Weekly.